Hey, ladies and gentlemen, Mike here. Just stopping in for a moment before the interview starts. I want to thank Larry one more time for allowing us to do the interview. He was extremely gracious, a good sport, and he let us pick his brain about acting, about his time on the show, and he even let us get dumb and ask some fun questions at the end. A true masterclass actor, wonderful man, and we really appreciated it. We wanted to do something great for you guys. And on a personal level, just being able to interview someone who was on the show, we're all here for one reason, and that's the X-Files. To be able to have an inside look from someone who was there, at least for four or five episodes, that means a lot, and it's very interesting. And I hope you guys find it as interesting as we did. So here it is, without further ado, the interview with Larry Musser.
This is Detective Matter, and you're listening to This Is Not Bleepin' Happening, another blankety bleep X-Files podcast with Mike and Andrew.
This is not happening.
Once again, thank you for being here. We're doing this. Hey. I wanted to reach out to you because we have been talking for a few years and off and on. Yeah. And as you may or may not know, the X-Files 30th anniversary is coming up of when the first episode premiered. So we're trying to do something special for the fans of our show. We've got a couple things planned, and this being one of them. So again, we do very much appreciate you being here.
That's good. I'm going to that event, leaving on September 7th and returning really? September 11th.
Oh, that's fantastic. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
I wish I could get out there. I have not been able to get out there to these events, but someday I'll get there.
Where are you guys? What city again?
I am in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin.
And okay.
Andrew?
I'm in Ottawa, Canada. So.
You're in Canada.
I am.
Well,
I know.
A fellow Canadian. How are you?
I'm very well. I had to school Mike on our dollar and $2 coins.
He did.
The loony and toony. Yeah,
exactly.
That usually gets a few laughs.
I appreciate the punnery. I really appreciate that.
It's a good one.
Yeah, there's a scene in what was that episode even? It was what was the last one we recorded where they're on the boat and Dodd-com. And there's a basic cutaway shot of the crew playing poker, and it pans up from a collection, the pot that they have, and it's a $2 bill and a bunch of loonies. And I was like, oh my god, a $2 bill.
Oh.
that is going back. So
yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, the $2 bill would be a hard one. Hang on to it if you get one of those, because they're very rare.
They're rare. They're actually worth more than $2 now. Go figure.
Oh, yeah. Considerably, I think.
Who'd all right, thought?
Mike, I'm sorry our Canadian-ness is boiling over.
No, I love
so
it.
We can.
Yeah, that's right.
I enjoy
Looties
it.
And toonies.
Looties and toonies. Well, just a quick icebreaker. We wanted to know a little bit about your acting and how you got started in the field.
How I got started in acting in general.
Just in general, you know, how it came across to you.
It started with me being in radio and going into audition for a show that was going to be on PBS. It was actually an educational program. Betty said, that's my wife. She said she was working in the advertising world, and she used to find people for commercials and stuff, then broke into casting. She became a top-notch Vancouver casting director. But at the time, she said, you should read for this. They're looking for this guy for this film, and he's you, basically. Mm. So you should go read for this. And I said, oh, I don't know. But then she convinced me. I went. I got the part, got real interested in acting, and found out everything I could about it. I did workshops. I did educational films, motivational films, document, whatever needed some acting part in it. I would try and go for that and kind of learn from there. I sort of learned on the job, I guess you might say, you know?
And very cool.
You started in film and TV. It wasn't like, as you suggested, conventional upbringing, like through theater school and going on stage.
No, I did plays afterwards. And I love them. In fact, I do mostly plays now. Mm-hmm. It's great. I really get into that. But no, I didn't come up through that way. I came through the media. I had been on radio And I'd done some things on television, you know, a few things. But as an actor, I started to do a lot of television. Yeah.
Yeah.
That all happened in Edmonton. I went back to Vancouver, which is my stomping ground, and the film business was burgeoning there. So I just slid right in, you know, and I got an agent, and away I went. And then before I even auditioned for it, I watched it on television and thought it was excellent. And I heard that that was being shot here in Vancouver. And I called my agent and I said, if anything comes up on that show that I can read for, please put me forward. And so I actually auditioned a few times before I got on there. And there was a couple parts I read for. I just wasn't right for, I guess, or whatever. You know, it's just they were looking for a different type of guy, whatever it was. But I finally got the role of Sheriff Oakes in that when it was a smaller part, but a good part, right? And that led to these other parts because they remembered me and called me back in to have a shot at Detective Manners because of that. So,
okay, that was actually another one of my questions was, did they call you to get into these other roles after you had already proven yourself on the first episode, or did you have to go in audition as kind of a newbie for each episode? But
not so much a newbie. They knew me when they called me in for Detective Manners, and they thought I would be good for that role. But they still called me in to read for it. You know, they still want to see that.
That's awesome.
You haven't suddenly lost a bunch of teeth, or you suddenly look like a drug dealer or something, you know, and so and you can still talk. So I did read the part, and they went great. And you know, before I even got home from that, my agent called and said, "You got it." They just said, "Yeah."
That is awesome. And
that
the
was
rest
delightful. That was delightful news for me.
Yeah,
I was going to say, did Betty vouch for you when she's doing all this casting at some point? Did she?
Well, you know, Betty was on her own path. And she sometimes called me in for Outer Limits, which I ended up doing a few of. She was casting for Outer Limits. But I was among many other people she called in. If I got the role, I got the role. It wasn't because Betty said I should have the role. Oh, yeah. That would look bad for her, you know.
Absolutely.
All the producers later said, that found out that we were married and said, "Oh, well, that's interesting." and then they, you know, they used to make jokes about that all the time. And those got tired, but no, they were kidding. They were fine about it. That once they learned and she did a bunch of MGM casting as well. So
really,
yeah, she was on her own thing. And sometimes we'd be on the same project, mostly not though.
So did your lives take you in different directions for extended periods of time then? Or did you all did you come home frequently and see each other, or did your lives kind of
We used to cross paths in the condo, in Vancouver.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, I mean sometimes she'd be working really late on some project I wasn't involved in, and vice versa. I'd be shooting on you know, night shots somewhere out way out in the countryside. So it wasn't like a regular normal family life, I can say that, but we still managed to spend quality time together and still do now.
That's great.
Now you mentioned being cast as Detective Manners for Jose Chung, and I've always wondered, you know, Kim Manners, obviously director, and he directed you in Die Hand Überlitz. Detective Manners, did you ever think that there's some connection there?
He actually directed me in the Stephen King one.
Yeah,
in Chunga.
Chinga. Chinga. Yeah.
He directed me in that one, but he knew I was doing him. Not doing him. I was doing a character named after
him. Okay.
Yeah. So he came into the set and, you know, expressed a lot of praise with what I was doing.
Oh.
Not that it was like him, just that he liked the character that I'd come up with. Right. Yeah.
Well,
so he thought of me when he did that other one.
Such a novel take with the self-censoring, or at least as in that script, Scully is censoring out his colorful language.
Yeah. All of us were. Yeah,
exactly.
Saying that, but it was just Detective Manners that brought it to the show.
Right.
And then they were all talking like that.
Yeah. Was was that audition process for that? Was that a different feel? Did you feel strange having to edit yourself?
Well, I actually, when I went in, I said, you know, this is, what do you want me to do here? Do you want me to actually say the swear word here at this, in this reading? And they said, no, stay bleep, stay blank, or any of that other stuff that comes up that's like bleep and blank, flippity or whatever you want to do. I said, oh, you want me to say bleep and blank? Okay.
That's awesome.
So then the character becomes a really great character, right? And I got right into it.
That's awesome.
I played with it.
Well, that leads to a question actually I had, where I've always been curious about when you get the script as an actor and you have an initial take on it. And then it goes through into production and then you arrive on set. I'm wondering how much does it transform between your vision of it and when you work with, I'm not sure whether you're working with an AD for some of your scenes or the director of the show, how much is there a transformation between the beginning and the end? Like, is it a vastly different thing or is it very much, no, this is how we gave it to you and this is how it's going to be?
Well, you know, for Detective Manners, it was pretty much how I did it when I went in and read it. They liked that and they said, just do that. Except every once in a while, they would add a little more punch on the bleeping alien or another bleep and this blank head's got, just a little more punch. And then later on, it was like, okay, less fire now. You're more tired. You're fed up with this. You're sick of this alien shit, right? So that's how I played it at the end, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, that's a bleeping dead alien body if I ever saw one. Like, see, by then I was getting tired of this.
Right.
And then when they did the autopsy and that, what was his name? He's a really funny actor. He's a good guy. When he comes
in the video camera.
But yeah, comes busting in to stop the, well, by then that fires me up again.
Yeah. Yeah. Get him out of the room.
So it was hills and valleys, and it was always the character I developed, but with suggestions from them, and sometimes from David too. He'd say, "Why don't you try this?" And then they say, "That'll give me something to do this with." And I, okay, let's do it that way.
Nice.
So that happened too.
Now, as far as direction, you worked, as we talked about, with Kim Manners and
Rob Bowman.
Rob Bowman.
Yeah, great guy.
And then Michael Lang, did you find yourself taking to one directing style more than another, or were you able to get your point across as best you could?
They were all good. They were all, you know, those people, most of the directors were also writer producers, right? So, they knew the show inside out. They knew what they wanted from it. They were part of the creative process of it. Their input was just golden to that show. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't going to stand there and say, oh, I know, that's a stupid idea. I'm going to do it this way.
Certainly not.
When they said, made a suggestion, I'd say, yeah, I wasn't lying. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Right. Now, who did the, I've forgotten the name, but now I played a
Unrequited?
Paramilitary guy.
Yeah.
That was Michael Lang.
Yeah, that was Michael. That was him. Mm-hmm. Now he pretty well let me just go the way I wanted with that character. He says you can be redneck or you can be too cool for the room or you can be a real asshole. And so I used a bit of each.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point. You know, we were just talking about Detective Manners and going to Denny Markham, who you play in Unrequited.
Yeah, that was Denny Markham. Yeah.
Two very different characters.
Yeah.
Did you find, that's two of four. You were on the show four times, and I believe you played like a different attitude each time. And I wanted to know, was there one of those characters in particular you found yourself preparing the most for, something that felt unnatural to you that you really, really wanted to drive home?
Yeah, that was Denny Markham for sure.
Denny?
Oh, yeah.
He's from the wrong side of the fence for me personally. You know,
he's more of a villain.
A guy that wants to blow everything up and has his own army. And at the same time, I kind of sided with him. You know, I found something in him I liked because he was abandoned by his own government after he came back from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So he's got a pretty good beef. Yeah, oh, yeah, he went about it the wrong way, a little bit extreme, and he became an extremist, mm-hmm. which is a terrorist almost, and that's not what I would do. But I certainly agreed with him that they let him down, right? Yeah. He did all that. He put his life on the line, and he showed that guy that disappeared and came back that they were trying to capture, mm-hmm. that he showed him the ropes and then was protecting him all the way through because he didn't mind if those generals got bumped off. What did they do for him? Right.
Right.
So I could sympathize with that part of him, not having all that weaponry and trying to blow up buildings, though. No, I would never do that.
No.
But right. So that's what I had to work on, that anger, you know?
Yeah.
Now, for Unrequited, when you're playing Denny Markham, how many shooting days did you get on that? Because I know you've said in previous interviews that it was all pretty, you know, it was all pretty tight to turn around a show in the time they had.
Yeah, well, they kept adding scenes for Denny Markham. Mm. To start off with, it was just supposed to be the arrest of him, you know, talking through the fence, and they take him away, does the little speech, and then it cuts to him in prison, mm-hmm. and that general comes up and starts to try and intimidate him. Mm-hmm. That's all there was at first, but then they started adding all these other things, like the shots where the FBI arms patrol is moving in on him, and, mm-hmm. and things like that, and then talking longer at the car before he was taken away, and then an extra scene with that general. That went on much longer. I kept getting called back to the set. So I ended up working probably 5 of the 7 days of shooting because they kept calling me up and said, can you come in? And I'd say, well, it's X-Files. Yeah, I'm coming in. As long as
absolutely.
As long as I wasn't on another set, then I wouldn't do that. Yeah. Once I did say that, I'm on the set. When I get off the set, I'll come right to you. And they said, great. Okay. So,
I can fit you in.
I think I got it.
I'll be there. Where are you shooting? And I just went right there.
Well, that's got to be cool because for such a character that you really had to find within yourself to keep being called back, probably based on your performance the days before and to benefit the episode, I think that's got to feel pretty good.
Well, yeah, that's it. They wanted to make the guy appear more because he was responsible for the guy they're looking for, the invisible guy. Mm-hmm. It turns out that's where he learned not how to bend light, how to bend light and disappear. But he learned basically all there is to know about being a Marine, being a soldier, mm-hmm. being a guy that fought for his own country and then got dumped on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And that's happened to a lot of people in that came out of that war, you know, that they kind of had their back turned on them. They couldn't even get a job, some of them. Right. Hence the character Rambo, right? There's another one. Right?
Yeah.
Well, certainly Chris Carter has a torch to bear for Vietnam stories. He's done more than his fair share.
Yes, I know. That's right. So
and it might
have been him that wanted to add scenes, but I have a feeling it was whoever wrote that wanted to flesh it out more, mm-hmm. and make him more... Well, just his back, do more with his backstory so you understood the other guy more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they didn't pad out the, you know, the main villain. It's funny. Traeger, I think is his name. But I mean, I don't really remember his performance as much as I remember your performance.
Peter. Oh, yeah. Peter. I haven't seen him for a long time. But I like him. He's a good guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the X-Files does this.
Did they catch him at the end? Yeah, they did.
Yeah,
he
ended up
dying. Doesn't get away. He doesn't get a sequel.
No sequel for him.
No.
Yes, we've joked that there are some villains that are, you know, so good the writers can't let them go, so they try and set it up so there's a possibility for a sequel. This guy doesn't get a sequel.
No, but they brought the guy that could bend your mind back for a second episode.
Oh, yeah.
Pusher.
Yeah.
I know him quite well. He's a good guy. And, it was a year later they had that character show up again and getting people to do what they didn't want to do all over again.
And he's my favorite, actually, especially
interesting. That was an interesting script, yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
I know. That was Robert Wisden. He's a good guy.
Yeah. He did a great job, and I liked him in He does a little bit of a bit part in Stargate. I saw him in that, and that was a pretty good role. Now, Andrew and I often joke about the actors and actresses they bring back for more than one episode. We joke that, you know, did they put a mustache on them to change their appearance so people wouldn't know?
Or glasses.
They didn't really do that with you. Was that ever talked about? Like, hey, we gotta throw some facial hair on you or something that made you appear different?
No, but for the police chief in Chinga, they just wanted me to be real clean cut, get a nice short haircut, and you know, look like a real New England cop.
Yeah,
basically. And you know, like clean shaven, salt of the earth, and of course, I played him like he was a bit of a goof too, which they liked.
Oh, right? So good.
It was better to have him a little bit goofy, like. just the things he said and the way he said them. I tried to do that for him. And that was an enjoyable character.
Now, you're a West Coast boy. How are you picking up East Coast mannerisms?
Oh, well, you know, I've actually always been interested in other accents, other ways of saying something. And like you say, mannerisms. Even when I wasn't acting, I was interested in that. You know, about and at a party way before I was an actor, I would become one of those guys and right and be like them. And they'd say, "What the hell are you doing anyway? Why are you talking like that?" I said, "Oh, I saw this guy in a movie who that's the way he talks," and you know, and so I was always interested in that.
Well, it sounds to me like you're destined to be an actor now
doing stage plays, you got to do that all the time,
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, because the actor is.
Sounds to me like you're a method actor then. You like to inhabit the character that you're presenting, not a sort of Brechtian outside-in kind of character actor.
Well, I do, but at the same time, I don't want to be like some people and take the character home with me.
Yeah.
I do, but when I leave the stage, I'm back to Larry again. I'm not going to be Billy or any of those other guys, the crazy guy Billy. I'm not going to come home being Billy. Although, I'll tell you what, Billy, that was a character. He was a guy who was trying to find himself in this play I just finished. He was an interesting character, and he kept waking me up at night saying his lines. Mm. So I still was Billy for quite a while after that play.
Yeah.
And I, not trying to be, but in my subconscious, I would wake up being that character again. And what the hell am I doing? And go for a walk and have a drink of water, and then I go back to sleep. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But yeah, he invaded me for a long time, Billy.
I can imagine it takes a certain level of discipline to be able to turn that off and back on whenever you need to. I think it's got to be difficult for some people, for sure.
Well, he did some wild speeches in this play, and there some of those are hard to forget, you know. And then he has a total breakdown at the end, so it was absorbing.
No doubt,
absorbing, and it became. I became Billy for all the time during the play, that's for sure.
So I'm fascinated then about your transformation into an actor on the boards compared to working for film and TV, because it's my impression, basically, they are opposite to each other in terms of what you're presenting. TV is very small, minute detail, you know, you're not evoking from the base, you know, it's all to the camera and very small, but on the stage, you got to sell it to the guy in the back row.
Exactly. So, you got to talk to him. If he's not hearing you, what you're doing doesn't really count, does it? Whereas television, it's like right there. Sometimes it's the camera's right in your face.
And they can tell you and, to go back maybe.
Yeah. But you know, I had only... While I was doing a lot of film work in Vancouver, and that was, say, from the mid-80s to the early 2000s, during those days, I didn't do very many plays.
Mm.
I was doing practically exclusively film and TV. It's when I moved up here to the Sunshine Coast, and there's this great theater company called the Heritage Theater, and I had health problems. I got out of the rat race of... film pursuits and auditions, and just wanted to stand back and chill out, and got interested in this Heritage stage company. And that's how I exercised all the acting energy that was still in me. I still haven't gone back to Vancouver and pursued the film and TV world like I did before.
Yeah.
Like if somebody calls me and says, oh, this is a great role for you, sure, I'll be interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't get on the rat race runner anymore. And, oh, yeah, I'll do that, I'll do that, and do that, do that, I'll be back in. No, I've stopped that now.
I have to imagine it's completely different now than it would have been in the 90s.
Oh, yeah, it is. See, and most of the auditions are, well, I've got a ring light. I got a ring light, and you put that around your phone and stand for your phone, and you talk into that. And, you know, a lot of people are real good at that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm good or not, but I don't like it that much.
No.
I'd rather come into a room and there's a bunch of people there and talk to the people.
Yeah.
You know, I just say, and then how about this for the character? And then you got input right away.
Yeah.
There, you're guessing the character and you're sending it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not the same.
Yeah, you lose that personal touch, that reactive interaction with the people.
Sure. And I don't do it all the time. If it's a really interesting character, I'll have a look at it. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, circling back, throughout your episodes, I wanted to kind of pick your brain about you probably spent more time with Jillian than you did with David. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah.
Did you two, by the time you're in Chinga, I'm assuming you guys had developed a little bit of a working relationship that was, you kind of were able to communicate a little bit better and kind of play off each other a little bit better? Is that? How did that go for you guys?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, in Chinga, it's her and I that are doing the investigation, and Mulder just has a couple phone calls where he's trying to harass her into looking into witchcraft, or he's throwing pencils into the roof, or whatever he was doing.
I should really get
that. He's only in a couple scenes, so it's just pretty much her and I in that one.
Yeah.
And sure, I had got to know Jillian, but much better on that shoot because we're in most of the scenes, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Again, another week of shooting and that was it?
Sorry, what was that?
Another week of shooting and that was all you got? Or?
Well, you always had, I think it was 8 days. They tried to do it in 8 days, and then that's why there were such long days.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'd have an extra one in there with a second unit while the main unit was shooting the next episode because they had to move on. They had to keep the cranking them out, right?
Yeah.
So the second unit would come and pick up another scene they wanted to add to the previously done one. So that was going on all the time.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But that was, she was great to work with. I loved working with her.
Did you and the other actors spend much time off camera together, or was it mostly segregated to trailers and things like that?
Well, you know, a fair amount, not a lot, because if you've been out in the field in the rain and, you know, or working really late at night to get that night shot, you pretty much wanted to, rather than hang around and BS with somebody, you'd rather go back to your room and just chill out for a while, and knowing that you had another scene you had to prepare for.
Mm-hmm.
So the rigorous schedule of the X-Files didn't allow for too much of that. Although on Jose Chung, David Duchovny and I did have a rock batting contest up in the mountains of Mount Seymour in the forest. Oh yeah. Yeah. I found a really good bat and I was smacking rocks and he came over and said, let me have a shot at that. We're seeing who could hit it the farthest.
That's
and then
awesome.
He broke the bat. He'll never admit that. It was a really nice bat I found, you know. Perfect. Well, you know, they used to play stickball at the back of the lot in North Van where the studio was for X-Files. They used to, Chris Carter and David and, well, whoever else was available. I played once, I think. And they'd have these stickball games, you know, one batter, one pitcher, one fielder.
Nice.
If you caught the ball, you were up. The pitcher struck the batter out, the pitcher's up. If the batter kept hitting, he stayed up. You know, if he kept getting a good hit, he stayed up.
What?
Yeah, so we were
did
playing.
You guys have time to play.
Well, I know. In that instance, I was just out there checking on something. I wasn't on that shoot, but those guys were on their lunch break doing this, and so I joined them for like an hour or something.
Nice. That's awesome.
I think they did it like for a lot of lunch breaks when they were at the studio, not out on location, but.
Yeah.
At the studio. Yeah, they used to love playing ball.
And for Chinga, the stand-in for the New England resort town, that I know that's somewhere in
that was Steveston.
Sorry, that was where?
That was Steveston or Ladner, maybe both, which is just south of Vancouver.
Right.
But Steveston is a big former fishing town, and Ladner has a bird sanctuary, a fantastic area, just it's a little island, and it's all the birds, it seems, of the world stop there on their migratory routes. You know, it's just a fantastic area. Yeah.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
You just have to rotate the camera 180 degrees, and now it looks like you're on the East Coast. So.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Maine. That was supposed to be Maine.
Exactly. Like,
some town in Maine.
I'm actually headed up
saying, somewhere. Yeah. They made sure I didn't say yeah, but it was
yep.
Did you have a dialect coach for that episode?
There was one there, and he was actually there more before. Chris Carter and Kim Manners called me in and said, "We just want you to talk to this guy for a while." And he, you know, a couple of the lines he'd say, "Oh yeah, okay, this has definitely got to be said this way. If you're going to be believable as a New England guy,
right?
You know, don't say it that other way. You said it more like West Texas there. No, this is New England." So he gave me a few hints. Yeah. Okay. But he wasn't there all the time on the set. He came up to me once, off camera, after in between a take and said, "You got a little bit away from the New England thing there." And then kind of pulled me back to it.
You gotta stay on target.
Yeah, stay as this guy up here, as police chief Bonsand. You were talking like another guy. I don't know who he was.
That wasn't somebody from New England, that's for sure.
It wasn't. He was suddenly wasn't from Maine. He seemed to be way down south. Okay.
Well, that leads me to another question, actually, and that would be. Were there shoots, sorry, I guess I should say, were there takes that you would have that you would go, "Oh, that was perfect," but yet you would be asked to do it again? Or more to the point, what showed up in the episode when you saw it, would you like think, "Wait a second, that wasn't as good as the other one where I nailed it"?
I thought that all the time. You know, most actors are never satisfied. You're never really happy with how you did it, or if somebody said, "Okay, do it this way," and you did it that way, you still weren't that. I could have tweaked it a bit there. I should have been louder here and pulled back there. It's never perfect.
Yeah.
Not in my mind, and a lot of actors I know are the same way. They say, some of them don't even want to see themselves.
Oh, really?
They say, "No, yeah, I don't know. I'm not watching."
it's that eternal strive to be better. I think you just in your head, you just keep picking yourself apart and, "Oh, I wish I could have done that better."
I think I can always do it better. I always think I can do it better. And if they say, "Well, we're doing another take," even if I thought that last one was good, I'll say, "Okay.
Yep.
Let's go again.
Let's go again.
And we'll try something else in here and we'll see where that goes."
So you would offer them something different, I guess, if they wanted to do another take, or are they concerned about the consistency? They want you to do it the exact same way every time.
Yeah, not too much different. I mean, if they say, "I like that, but let's do it, take it again." And this time it might just be look over there first, but then look back, or just move a little bit to this side, or look over at Jillian when you say this part. They would very seldom say, "Do the dialogue any different." Very seldom. But it would be something to do with the lighting, the positioning, the blocking, the movement of the character. That would usually be the retake, or some light. They'd reset a light and do it. You know, there's all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Or if they didn't like the performance, they would tell you and say, "You got to bring it up. You know, punch it up." And sure, I'd be always happy to do that. But I'd still do it the same. Basic core of the way I was presenting it, just with that more energy, right?
Yeah. And when you're working these scenes, are you working with the director or are you working with an assistant director? Or I guess maybe it depends on the moment, but like who's generally in charge of that set?
It's almost always, I'm speaking for X-Files.
Yeah.
It's almost always the director and the DOP.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
So they don't hand anything off. It's them.
Yeah. Oh, no, they don't. They're right there.
Yeah, yeah.
They're right there. I mean, as I said, they're also writer producers. So and then after they've given you instructions, they'll go back to the monitor tent area and be watching everything. So, yeah, they're involved fully.
Well, I guess they don't have the luxury to step away if they've only got 8 shooting days. They have to have their thumb on everything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then they're going back to the back to the lab and editing, and we're looking at this and going through all the takes. And I wasn't sure when those guys slept, some of them, they would have written it too. Right.
Yeah.
Although not too many of the writers were directors. A lot of the writers are producers though, mm-hmm. You know, like Frank Spotnitz and Darren
Morgan,
Darren Morgan. They didn't, maybe Darren Morgan did direct one. I'm not sure.
He directed one, I think, in the reboot seasons.
Okay.
But he did write several for the original.
Yeah, he
run.
Wrote lots, and so did Frank. And Frank was a producer, and and Kim directed and wrote and produced, I think. Maybe he didn't write much. Maybe he just directed and produced.
I think Kim just was a producer director. I don't think he was
a producer director. You're probably Yeah, and same with Rob Bowman, right? He was producer director. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of busy schedules, those two, I would say, are their most active directors on that show. So going from one episode to the next must have been exhausting.
Yeah. And I think Frank might be directing something now. He does a lot of productions in Europe. And I think he more than just writes those, because he was talking about them at the last X-Files convention before COVID rolled in. And that one was in Chicago in 2019.
I missed that one too. I'm so close to that.
You're in Wisconsin. That would have been a fairly short hop for you, right?
Yeah, a couple hours.
So are you near Milwaukee?
I am just south of Milwaukee. I'm in Janesville, Wisconsin, which is right on the border. Of Illinois and Wisconsin.
Well, I saw lots of signs there, you know, when I was in Chicago, Milwaukee this way, this off ramp to Milwaukee. So it seemed like it wasn't too far.
No. Yeah, I'm about the same distance, I would say, from Milwaukee as I am from Chicago.
Okay.
So we wanted to, we're running short on time here a little bit. Andrew.
Geez, look, see, that time goes fast.
That time goes fast.
When you're having fun.
Right. Well,
this is fun. This is always fun for me.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad. Not painful, like we were promising.
Yeah. We omitted the pain.
Good. I appreciate that. Always happy with that.
Well, I wanted to ask, Larry, I know that you've done a number of these interviews from, you know, X-Files obsessed people, and I'm sure that you have answered a lot of the same kinds of questions, a lot of, you know, what's it like to work with David and Duchovny and all the rest. And of course, I mean, obviously we'll take any war stories you want, but are there any questions you wish people would ask you, but it never comes up, you know?
Well, now I think there are a lot of questions that I would like to answer. And I think we're dealing with them right here, aren't we? I mean, I can't, you know, I think we're on the right track.
We're about to
get
off track.
Outside of X-Files, there were a lot of things I could talk about. But, you know, I know this show is about X-Files, so we're sticking to that.
Oh, it's all right. Well, this next segment is not going to be about the X-Files. But
okay, whatever you want then.
Andrew and I wanted to do something fun. We're going to rapid fire you some really ridiculous questions. But something fun for the listeners. We're going to take them one at a time. And just answer with whatever comes to mind.
Whatever comes to mind.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
So fire away. Starting off, what's your favorite food?
Oh, favorite food is pasta bolognese.
Ooh, excellent choice.
Excellent.
Mm.
Who is your favorite actor or actress?
Oh, easy. I worked with him for over a month. Anthony Hopkins is my favorite actor.
Oh, and The Edge.
Yeah. Favorite actress, there are many that I worked with that were just absolutely delightful. Watching from afar somebody that I have never worked with. This might surprise you, but right now my favorite actress is Ana de Armas.
Really?
Do you know her? She's a Spanish woman.
I don't. What would we?
And my second favorite is Margot Robbie.
Oh,
in fact, they might pretty well be tied for first because they can do so many different characters so well, and they're both just really gorgeous women, right? And Ana de Armas did a knockout version of Marilyn Monroe. I've never seen it done that well ever, and you know, and she's a swarthy Spanish Hispanic girl, and no problem. Maybe. And she put on makeup and put on the blonde wig. And she was Marilyn, I'm telling you.
Okay.
So got her up into my favorite category. Margot Robbie. She's just brilliant in everything.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
So she's got to be up there.
I just saw
her last night in Barbie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nice. How'd you like that?
I liked it. Yeah. I thought it was very entertaining, very creative. And, you know, it had this little point to make there. It maybe got a bit preachy at one point, but that's okay.
That's all right.
My favorite takeaway.
Yeah, go ahead and keep firing away. Sorry,
Yeah, we're way off of these.
No, you're going. You're all right. Go for it. Okay, okay. On that same vein, what is your favorite movie? If you had to pick one.
Oh, gosh, there's just so many that, you know, in this genre, like the sci-fi world, I've never been so astounded by a movie as I was by the first Alien that came out.
It's so excellent.
The very first one.
That's exactly where my mind went to. But yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. Alien is so trend busting.
Yep.
That was just amazing. Look at how many movies today still use stuff from that picture.
Yeah.
And for the same reason, I'm going to go way back farther to a movie from the 40s, Casablanca. Casablanca with Humphrey Bogart and what's her name? The Swedish actress. Brilliant Swedish actress. Ingrid Bergman. And you know, Peter Lorre's in it, and Sidney Greenstreet, all those guys are in it. And you know, there are lines from that movie that have become movies. You know,
right?
Yeah,
that's a phenomenal movie for it's that. So it just lives on and lives on.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to pick that one, right?
Well,
and away from that kind of wartime and darkness, like just a fun movie. I like so many. I don't know if I could really single one out, you know.
Well, you've already given us two, all right? I think you've...
maybe Eddie Murphy, you know, the early Eddie Murphys, like changing places and the one where he was, Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, yeah.
That's an excellent movie.
there's a lot of laughs in those movies. And going back farther, the second Peter Sellers doing... Clouseau, it was called Shot in the Dark.
Pink Panther.
After Pink Panther, Shot in the Dark.
Okay. Oh, Shot in the Dark.
Gotcha.
Oh, that just, I was sore from laughing at that one.
Well.
I digressed.
Well answered on the favorite movie question, for sure.
Absolutely. Okay. I agree with you on Alien. That is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, well, gosh,
all classic movies.
Oh, yeah.
Next rapid fire question. If you could travel somewhere right now, where would it be?
If I could travel in time, just to a place?
I thought maybe we should ask a time travel question. It's going to be a time travel question. Yes. If you could go to any point in time and space.
You know, even though it would be extremely dangerous and would throw me on a whole different path in life, I would go back to the Kimberley Ski Hill in March of 1965 and not make that last run. The last run where I broke my leg. Ooh. And was about to be scouted that spring by Major League Baseball scouts.
Oh, man.
Oh, wow.
That was gone.
Yeah.
That was gone.
That's rough.
Now, I'm not saying I would have been scouted and made it, but I would have at least been scouted. That's why I said it's dangerous. I probably never would have become involved in acting. And I wouldn't have known what I'd missed. So, you know, really, we can't look at one of those as better than the other. But right. I still would have done that. Because I wanted to find out. That's something that I'll never know.
Absolutely.
I wanted to find out. This guy saw me playing baseball at a tournament in Spokane, Washington. And I was playing. Kimberley used to have. That's in the interior of British Columbia. Vancouver's on the coast. Kimberley was where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Great baseball in Kimberley. We played against a lot of American teams. And we had this team made up of seniors and juniors, and we took them to everybody went to this tournament, and I had a great tournament. And this guy came up afterwards and said, I'm kind of a stringer scout, and I work for both the Yankees and the Giants, and I'm going to tell them about you. And I went,
wow.
Oh, okay. and he had a friend in Kimberly who was an accountant. He used to give him, like, he used to come to all the ball games, and he used to give him tips. And he said, I know Max. And he said, I'm going to come up there and see you and have one of these guys, or maybe both of them, see you. And it'll be sometime in the summer of next year. And that was the year I broke my leg. Oh, broke my leg spring skiing, March. I wasn't ready to play ball till late August or something.
And the scouts had moved on.
They hardly used to even stop in Canada in those days. Now there's the Toronto Blue Jays. They got scouting stations all across the country. Timing was off. Yeah. You know?
But now if you need to be scouted, you got to put the ring light on and act and, you know, throw your ball to a cell
true.
Phone. And
just go to the other end of the room.
Yeah.
That's send true. The video we'll in. Just, and... I'll wind up and throw a knuckleball. No, I was a shortstop. I played shortstop. Okay. And I used to switch hit.
And do you still play
baseball? He was curious of a switch hitting shortstop. Back then, there weren't so many. There's dozens of them now. But back then, there was like Mickey Mantle. That was it. You know, Mickey Mantle. He was the switch hitter.
Right.
And I learned to switch hit because of him.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've answered my question very well.
All right.
Well, okay. That's good. I probably said more than you needed or wanted. Well, it's supposed to be a rapid fire.
Our rapid fire is getting less rapid, but that's okay. I'm all right with the expanded answer. I think it's more interesting.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Would you rather be invisible or be able to fly?
Ooh. Gee. I'm going to take fly. If I could fly myself to Minneapolis in September, no, I wouldn't do that. I'd be carrying luggage. That'd be bad. Well,
maybe you could fly with luggage. Who knows?
Flying with luggage. If, it comes with super if I had somebody else who could fly with me and they had the luggage.
There you go.
Invisible would be great, though. You know, it would have its advantages, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I think the invisible would be pretty cool, too. But flying would be cool.
Very cool to be invisible.
Next rapid fire question. Larry, do you have a favorite book? Are you much of a reader?
I read a lot of books, and some of them are memorable. You know, and of course I read Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings and those sci-fi things. Those are fantastic. But so is the books by Ken Follett, massive. Oh.
Yeah, the Pillars of the
Earth. You know, like historical fiction stuff. Mm-hmm. Those are great in their own right, you see. So, you know, I can't honestly say I've got a favorite book. I've got some books I really like in different genres. And, the Stephen King book, The Stand, blew me away. And so did The Shining. The Stand and The Shining, I was glued to those books. Why?
Yeah.
See, I've gone back to the dark side again now. I was away from sci-fi and horror, and now I've gone right back into it. Okay, no. Catch 22 I liked, and I liked Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, classics, yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite band or musician?
Okay. Favorite band, Pink Floyd.
Nice.
Pink Floyd, and favorite musician, Roger Waters. The current version of Pink Floyd is great, but Roger Waters isn't in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
You know, the guy really created Pink Floyd and designed them and came up with most of the concepts and wrote the bulk of the music. I know David Gilmour wrote some good songs too. I'm not, and the other guys did their thing, but Roger Waters' concert is Pink Floyd. Mm-hmm. He's got sidemen instead of those great guys. He's got sidemen now.
Yeah.
So those are the two. But I've got a real long list of very close favorites. When I was a young guy, I saw Led Zeppelin and I saw Jimi Hendrix. And I saw those bands and the one of the best live performing bands. I don't know why they don't get the credit they did. The best live performing bands I saw was Jethro Tull They put on a fantastic show.
I hear
amazing.
They do that.
And they used to sell bazillions of records in those days. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow they're not included with, Yes. And some of the other bands from that era that are all in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and they're not. I don't get that. But
maybe they offended used to the wrong knock person. Me.
I don't know, whatever it was. It might be a political thing, but they used to, their concerts used to knock me out. That's nice. Fantastic. And I like jazz and I like classical. I go to the concert series here that's a recital concert, chamber music, and I like it all, man.
Nice.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Mike wants me to ask whether you prefer square cut or triangle cut pizza.
I like how you just slumped that off on me.
Threw you under the bus? Yeah.
No, you know what?
It's hard-hitting journalism.
If it tastes good, I'd even eat a round one.
That's true.
You know, no, I almost always have triangle cut. Almost all.
Yeah, it's a very Canadian thing. I don't know this square cut pizza you talk on.
Well, yeah, those Chicago deep dish ones, aren't they? Aren't they? Sort
yeah, they can be, depending on the size of the actual pie, yeah.
What's that famous pizza place in Chicago, the deep something deep dish pizzas?
It's Giordano's, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, those are big squares. Nothing wrong with them.
No, it's fantastic.
You probably can't get a Hawaiian pizza in the States, though. That's a Canadian innovation.
Is it?
Yeah, totally.
You can't get Hawaiian pizza. You can't get pineapple on a pizza there.
Well, maybe you can if you ask super nicely, but I know they didn't invent it. I know we did.
Oh.
Okay.
And it's triangle cut, sir, I'm sure.
It's triangle.
Triangle cut. Yes. Okay, maybe it is. All right.
We've only got a few more. If you could have acted in any film or play, which would it have been? If there was a role that you didn't get or you really wanted to.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm.
Nice.
Jack Nicholson's part.
That's pretty seminal role right there.
We were going to do that play at one time, and I was just too green as an actor even. I just started getting interested in acting. And somebody talked to me about it because they said, you know, you remind me a little bit of Jack Nicholson in your certain things you say and do. And I went, I'm not doing that part. That's just too, I honestly, that's, no, not ready for. Now I could see I could do it. Yeah. I could do it my own way, but I could do it.
Give it your own flavor.
I'm sure it would have been your own way even then, but it's a lot of responsibility.
I think it would have been a favorite flavor.
Yes.
Or did you say?
Oh, no, I was saying you could have given the role your flavor and made it your own.
Yeah, I love Jack Nicholson. He's fantastic.
Absolutely.
But I would have done some things a little bit different. A little bit different, you know, just have to do it my own way.
Right.
And that's such a great character. Guy who pretends. See, I've played crazy guys now on stage. This is a guy who pretends to be crazy and then gets, you know, the ultimate happened to him because he was pissing around and pissed off the wrong people by pretending to be crazy and then got himself a lobotomy, right? I mean, that's just a wild role, I'll tell you.
Absolutely.
He goes to an asylum so he can escape a prison sentence and ends up, well, I don't know if you have seen the film. I don't want to spoil it.
Oh, no, you're good.
Have you seen the film?
I saw it, but it's been a while. So it's one of those things where I don't have to see it again.
There's a Netflix series now based on that nurse in that movie, Nurse Ratched.
Mm. Oh, really?
It's a young version of Nurse Ratched. It's on Netflix.
Nice.
Which goes to show you can make a Netflix series about anything.
Yeah, I know. Okay, that's the truth, isn't it?
Well, there is a follow up to that about picking a favorite character you've ever played. So I'll ask that: if you had to pick a favorite character that you have played. Who would it be and why? It does not have to be X-Files.
No, favorite character I've played. Yeah, yeah. I played some pretty interesting guys in made-for-TV movies that, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't really get made anymore, right? Yeah. Made-for-TV movies. But I used to play
frequent.
Some. Yeah. They're not a big thing. They used to be one of my staples back then, you know. That's what I used to do a lot of. Was made-for-TV movies. I'd play either a cop or a dad or a killer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, or a slightly crazy guy, or a drug guy, maybe. I can't pick one. I cannot pick one one favorite. You know, I, in one way or another, I found something to like about all of them. Mm. I just can't pick one.
Yeah, that's also fair. An answer.
Okay.
Well, and then the last question is something Andrew, I know, has been dying to ask. Read it, Andrew. Read the question.
Okay. I have read it, but it says Mike will ask this question. So.
Hey, whatever it is, you don't have to be afraid.
Finally, what everyone listening wants to know, Mulder Scully romance or no Mulder Scully romance?
Well, you know what? I wouldn't have thought so at first, but now I'm tending to think that. And I'll tell you why. It's all the people that I'm connected to on Twitter who were at the X-Files convention in Chicago and who've become really good friends. And I'm in touch with them a lot. They all believe there is one.
Okay.
So they got a name for themselves too.
Shippers?
Yes, shippers. Yes.
Andrew's shippers. A big one of those.
Okay. I'm not, sir.
I am not, sir.
So they're all shippers, and they've presented so much evidence over the years. I'll go, yes, okay.
I mean, I believe you.
You've bent me to your side of thinking on that. So I'll say, originally no, now maybe.
Well, then, all right. Maybe there's hope for me. One day I will see the light that it's all a big
Yeah, because you say no.
I don't think so. I think that the appeal of the show is that they do not need to delve into that trope of, you know, will they, won't they. They're partners, you know. They have a goal. But I know that the show itself leans in heavy to the romantic angle because, frankly, when you get to 9 seasons, you kind of run out of stuff and you got to go there.
Well, you know, they're talking about the Scully having his child, right? And keeping that quiet and all that kind of thing. These girls are piling evidence at me of all of that. I'm going, well, you know, I can be taken too. No, okay. All right. No.
Playing a dangerous game, arguing.
I just say, okay, I'm not arguing it. You're right.
Do you ever have to tell a fan, you know, remind them that it's a television show and they're not actual people?
Oh, right. You know, certainly not at these conventions. The people there are great. They really are. I know they're wild about the show, but they're also nice people, good people, very respectful, very genuine, very honest, and nice to be around. So. Yeah. Definitely not. But there was, when I was doing the show back in those days, there'd be somebody who was yelling at me about, I had full United States Army Colonel stuff on for a made-for-TV movie.
Oh, yeah.
And this guy was really raking me over the coals about all the shit America's doing around the world. You know? And I said, you know what? I'm getting paid for putting this on. I'm not actually this. And he says, what do you mean? I said, see that building over there? We're shooting a film in that. You know, I'd gone out for a walk to get some fresh air out of supposed to be the big conference room of all the military guys. Mm. And he said, oh, well, okay then. But he was up and down me thinking I really was an American colonel.
Oh, well, wow.
So that just happened. Yes.
Larry, I think that just speaks to what a good actor you are.
Oh, okay.
You just fade into those roles.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Absolutely.
Even when you're not putting it on, you convinced him that you were a full-on Army colonel.
Well, I guess it must have been the way. The thing is, I had to walk really up straight to being that character. Always out. And I was walking out there, I was making sure I was strutting like that, like a general would when he comes into the room. There's a certain march you got to do. So that the rest of the company knows you're there and they all salute, right? Mm-hmm. So I was working on that. And this guy comes up and just starts shouting at me, right, about about the horrible stuff that the American military has done.
Oh,
I wasn't
going
to get into that with him. Yeah. He was pretty wound up until I just mentioned to him that this is costume. That's where we're shooting the film. please don't tell me anymore about American politics. That's not why I'm here. Oh,
yeah.
That wow. What a moment.
Gary, well, look at all these wackos now that are, you know, the conspiracy people and the, you know, I can't even go there, you know?
Well, Mike and I have often thought that one of the reasons as the X-Files was so popular was because it tapped into a conspiracy theory mindset before we even really had a name for it. You know, it was, it just hit that zeitgeist right when it was peaking.
That's right. Yeah, that was all conspiracy.
Yeah.
Considered that. Yeah. Those were the conspiracists then.
And not look at them now. Don't believe anything now.
Yeah. Not like these guys.
No, there are some definitely way outer people out there now.
Oh, yeah.
Beyond the outer limits.
Way beyond outer limits.
Oh, yeah. Well.
Well, okay, guys. I enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you
making
very
it
much.
A fun afternoon.
It has been such a pleasure to have you on, and we both really appreciate you taking the time to do this. This means a lot.
Very much so. And I know our fans are going to be our fans. Your fans is what we're really
fans.
Our listeners are really going to – they're going to really appreciate this, though, because I think you offer some – I've learned a lot about just how these shows were put together. Like, you can read everything you want on the internet, but it doesn't give you that firsthand experience of what it was like to literally be there.
Yeah,
to be on a set is unlike anything else. Really, it's unlike anything else.
And it's always exciting to learn the behind the scenes stuff from the people who were there. So that it's really exciting for me and Andrew. So
it's always different. I mean, maybe not for Mulder and Scully because they've it was episode 12 and they'd been out in the rain for 8 straight nights.
Right,
maybe they're saying yes, it's always the same old, they might say that.
They'd say there's nothing like being on set.
Yeah, exactly.
Another day.
But for me, it's a different set each time, and it's a different group of people, and you know what I mean? It's exciting.
Absolutely.
Okay, guys.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm going to duck out now. Is that okay?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's been a great pleasure, Larry. Thank you so much.
Pleasure talking to you. See ya.
We'll see ya. Thank you.
All the best.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review on your podcast app of choice. Andrew and I would be eternally grateful to you fine, fine people for helping us expand and get the word out. Also, we've got a killer group on Facebook. Feel free to join in on the discussion at facebook.com/groups/thisisnothappeningpod and become an official member of the syndicate. We do polls and we have questions for every episode to give you guys the opportunity to chime in and possibly let your voice be heard on our recordings. And please join us on our new Twitter at @TINHXFilesPod, no dash, to stay up to date on everything moment to moment. Thank you, and remember, don't stop swimming.